I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. Science and politics seem to be strange bedfellows indeed. Science, after all, is about the search for truth. Politics, the search for compromise. Yet much of the money for scientific research comes from Congress, billions of dollars worth every year. Just this week, President Bush announced a major push into outer space with the goal of putting man on Mars within the next decade, and with a future administration footing the bill. The week ended with the Bush administration in retreat on another scientific frontier, in vitro fertilization. The administration had been expected to announce proposals for tracking embryos and identifying them as children-to-be. But under pressure from patients and privacy groups, backed off, and instead issued a rather lackluster update on the state of stem cell research. All of which leads to the questions we're putting to you this hour. What is the appropriate balance between scientific inquiry and political reality? What kind of science is the Bush administration supporting? And is it the right kind? Are the decisions being made in Washington based on objective scientific principles or on more narrow political calculations? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington are two people who have thought deeply about these issues. Don Kennedy is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, professor emeritus of environmental science, and president emeritus of Stanford University in California. Welcome, Don. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
And Daniel Greenberg, a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and author of The Politics of Pure Science. Welcome, Dan.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Dan, I want to start with you by asking you to reflect on what we've seen this week, the announcement about the space program and yesterday's about not regulating embryo research. What do these two events have to tell us about the Bush administration's view on science?
Well, I think the Bush administration has followed the scientific issues in the same way it's followed many others, and that is it has played to its political audiences. As far as the forthcoming report on in vitro fertilization, the Bush administration has a core constituency of religious fundamentalists. This will not offend them. And on the other hand, a lot of people will say that, you know, since they decided not to track the embryos, the danger has not arrived that has been feared for so long. As far as the space program goes, as was pointed out in the introduction, the bill will fall to the next president or maybe two or three presidents down the line, while at this point the administration reaps the glory of saying we have a great vision in space. Just as with the Medicare drug benefit, they leave behind the question and pay no attention to it, how are we going to pay for this? And it's always very visionary to say we're going to go to Mars. The bill for that will be somewhere between $500 billion and $1 trillion. Where from? There's no commentary from the administration on that subject.
So I think
they reap the glory. They avoid some of the dangerous minefields as far as the in vitro issue goes at this point. And they leave many of these problems to the future.
And as the Washington Post was reporting this morning, private industry has been pushing NASA for years to think about a space station on the moon. I mean, obviously, there are billions of dollars to be made here in private contracts.
Well, private industry is quite delighted about this. I think what's left out of the equation is the fact that the public really doesn't have very much interest on seeing more people tumbling inside of spaceships. That's been going on now for 15 or 20 years. And it just doesn't play as well. So they rely upon the old stories about, you know, the romance of exploration and man must reach out to the outer spaces and things of that sort. I don't see the public really lining up to have its taxes raised for the purpose of paying for space exploration. The administration is for tax cuts all along the line. The question of how this is going to be paid for really has not received any attention at all politically.
And, Don, I want to hear you weighing in on this as well. Is the push here one from private industry, or is it scientific inquiry that's behind it?
I'm not sure how much private industry has supported the space announcement. What troubles me about it much more is that it puts science in the back seat and it puts the human exploration piece in the front seat. You know, there's a long argument that's been brewing between people who favor manned space exploration and those who are committed to doing the kind of science that will enable us to do the kind of robotic geology that's happening on Mars right now, to build the Hubble telescope and its successors, to collect stardust from comets, which is happening right now. And it seems to me that politics did get a bit the upper hand here, because what the president has counted on is the drama and romance of human exploration, and it's left aside the question of how much we can do in unmanned missions, and that's a disappointment.
Mm. And, Don, do you also see a disconnect between the sort of all systems go on a new space program and a don't go there on some areas of biomedical research? In other words, you know, not all scientific inquiry appears to be created equal. One seems safe, the other seems much more potentially explosive.
Well, the limitations on stem cell research have been deeply disturbing to almost all the biologists that I've been in touch with in the context of our work at Science. The limitations of those cell lines that were announced in the August 2001 pronouncement from the White House have turned out to be very seriously limiting. There are only 9 or 11, depending on how you count them. Those lines have all been developed using mouse feeder cells.
Don, I have to stop you. I need a refresher course. Remind us what the stem cell lines are all about.
The stem cell lines were those that preexisted at the time of the August 2001 announcement. They are the ones that President Bush said could be used in future stem cell research. They have been cultured using mouse cells that are essential, apparently, for cross-feeding the developing human cells. Those can't be used, presumably, in human therapy experiments because there's some risk that viruses or other particles might be contaminants due to the presence of the mouse cells. So almost everybody who does serious biology on stem cells thinks that they're not very useful.
And so the Bush administration is resisting this because they view all embryos as being potential children?
I think that the religious considerations have really trumped the science in this particular case. There are serious objections which are reflected in legislation proposed in the Senate by Senator Brownback and already passed in the House due to Congressman Weldon that not only prevent the development of further stem cell lines, but also would criminalize experiments in which one took already approved stem cells and used them in nuclear transfer experiments.
Mm. Dan Greenberg, was it ever thus? I mean, during the Nixon years, for instance, there was a similar tug of war about ideology. Is this something new we're seeing, or is this simply the way it works?
Well, reproductive biology has always been kind of a very dangerous area in politics, and I think that the biomedical research community realizes this and has never pushed very hard on issues that involve, that can be related in some way directly or indirectly to abortion or birth control or things of that sort. The animosity that existed between the Nixon administration and the scientific community, I think, was probably the high watermark in that kind of relationship. But what Nixon, as was pointed out, abolished the White House Science Office and did it very angrily. He felt the scientists were being disloyal to him. Things have been rebuilt. The White House Science Office is now well established. But there is a feeling, I think, in the scientific community today that this administration perhaps is more resistant to the interests of the scientific community, the environmental interests, the interests in arms control, in freedom of research, and the appointments to government advisory committees that deal with scientific and technical issues on a basis purely of professionalism, that this administration has gone way, way off the mark in dealing with those issues. And while scientists are not very outspoken and not very combative, I think that the feelings inside the scientific community, particularly the leadership in Washington, are that this is an administration that is hostile to many of the basic interests of the scientific community.
Well, we can certainly understand why that would be of great concern within the scientific community, but why should the rest of us be perturbed about it?
Well, I think the rest of us depend very, very heavily upon the scientific community for many good things in life, whether it's a purity of the environment, progress in medical research, safety in international relations, arms control, matters in many, many matters particularly related to health. The scientific community is heavily involved there. There's nobody else to rely on, really, but the professionalism and the quality of the scientific research and the scientific community that produces it. So I think the rest of us have every reason to be concerned about it.
And Don Kennedy, we should be careful here, I assume, not to think that there is a scientific community that speaks with one voice. Or is there?
I think the scientific community divides divides itself along many lines and on many issues. But I must say that on this one, there's a good deal of unanimity. I think there's a concern that in this administration, there have been more efforts to introduce political influence to the appointments of people on scientific advisory committees for government agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, the information that's distributed, made available to the public on government websites. For example, the National Cancer Institute website was altered after the Bush administration began to eliminate a scientifically based statement that there was no relationship between abortion history and the risk of breast cancer in order to eliminate that reassurance. So that gets people concerned. Of course, the problem is that you run into assertions, somewhat correct, that this kind of thing has gone on in past administrations. It has. The question is more of it happening now? And I think most of my scientific colleagues believe that this is a new high water mark.
And Don Kennedy, as the former president of Stanford, what do you see as the possible chilling effect on funding for university research? A lot of universities, as you know, are quite dependent on that amount of money.
There hasn't been an impact on funding decisions. Those are largely made by the Congress. I think there has been a tradition in the Congress to believe, quite correctly in my judgment, that scientific progress and rates of scientific innovation are very important to the national welfare. I mean, the economic payoff from basic research in biomedicine and pharmaceutical research, for example, is very high. So there's a lot of sympathy, and we welcome it, in the Congress for scientific research. I don't think that's under any serious threat.
This hour, we're talking about the politics of science, and we want to hear from you. What is the appropriate balance between scientific inquiry and political reality? What kind of science is the Bush administration supporting, and is it the right kind? Are the decisions being made in Washington based on objective scientific principles or on more narrow political calculations? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection from NPR. Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My guests this hour are Daniel Greenberg, author of Science, Money, and Politics, and Don Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science Magazine. We're discussing the balance between scientific inquiry and political reality. And Connection listeners, we're asking you, do you think the decisions being made in Washington are based on straight science? Or do you think it's politics at work? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we want to hear now from Eric, who's on the line from Boston. Hi, Eric, and welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. My name is Eric Kupferberg. I'm calling from Harvard Medical School. I'm wondering if we could ask our guest to comment on two things that came out of Representative Waxman's office in Washington, Henry Waxman. The first is the changes to the National Healthcare Disparities Report, where essentially the Bush administration has removed most of the references to disparities in the new report, and instead of the report saying that it's a national problem that affects every level of healthcare, they mostly say, gee, there are differences and there are a lot of successes for minorities. And the second was the hit list that was constructed by the Traditional Values Coalition, handed to Republican congressmen in the fall, and forced NIH officials to contact 150 scientists researching HIV, AIDS, human sexuality, and risk-taking behaviors to justify their work.
Dan Greenberg, I wonder if you'd like to start us.
Well, the tinkering with the disparities report, I think, is typical of this administration. They will have an expert panel produce a report that I think can stand up to professional scrutiny. And then the politicians in the White House or over in the Health and Human Services Department will go over it and revise it for political purposes. And huge distortions, as Eric pointed out, can ensue from that process. As far as the Traditional Values Coalition making up a hit list of scientists who have been involved in the kind of research that is offensive to this administration, that list has circulated around. I think that NIH, which was the target, the National Institutes of Health, which was the target of this list, has been pretty resistant to many of these attempts to take over its operations for political or ideological purposes. And one thing I think that remains a very powerful in behalf of the traditional values and interests of the scientific community is the instrument of embarrassment. The administration often does retreat, as it did on the website about the relationship between abortion and breast cancer. It does retreat when this is brought to public attention. And I think they're backing off on this hit list of from the Traditional Values Coalition. So there are ways of fighting back, but there's no question that the administration has its ideological goals, and they keep pursuing them very diligently.
Eric, from your position at Harvard Medical School, is this something new for you? Did you see anything like this during the Clinton years, for example?
Well, no. Actually, I believe that many priorities of what to fund and what not to fund are political decisions. I mean, that's the responsibility of Congress and the executive branch. There is a two-stage review process, though, at NIH, where one review process merely judges the merits of a grant proposal. The other, then, would determine what kind of money gets funded. What's unusual about the Bush administration is the goal of defunding projects, of scaring researchers away from certain topics, of forcing them to change keywords in their grants to sort of hide what they may be researching or not researching. I think we have a new level of almost scientific McCarthyism now.
And is it, well, it sounds then as if you're saying there is a chilling effect. It's a
yes.
lot of trouble to write a grant application. So if you think you're not going to be funded for stem cell research, for example, you'll, what, do something else?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Or, for example, if you're studying problems of HIV transmission, you might move or shy away from topics that are important to it, which are risk-taking behavior, the relationship between multiple sex partners and drug usage, the notion of stigmatization, all of those topics which are part and parcel of effective programs to combat HIV transmission might not be researched as a result of being politically unpalatable.
And
since I'm since I'm down here in Washington, where it's not quite a record low yet, I'd like to give something encouraging for Eric up in Boston to contemplate. First of all, I think the Traditional Values Coalition arrived dead. I think the Congress, many members of the Congress, were concerned about that. NIH did little. The proposals looked silly, and I think they disappear. There is something, though, in this whole suite of events that troubles me, and that is that, as Eric points out, the funding process involves, first of all, a strictly scientific, always has involved, a strictly scientific measure of merit, followed by some funding decisions. One would worry terribly if the persons, the scientists involved in the peer review of the grant applications, began to be appointed on a political basis. And at least in a couple of cases, the politics of appointment found its way downward to NIH or HHS study section levels. And I think what we need to make sure of is that in this administration and in the future, those kinds of positions are made immune to that kind of political manipulation.
What about that, Eric? Does that make you feel better?
A little bit. I'm mostly worried that the chilling effect might, since the funding relies on researchers applying for grants, that the funding decisions might have a chilling effect right where the research begins, even before the review process. Mm. Now, if most of the people who are applying for these grants do not feel that their grants might be turned down on a political basis, then you don't have to worry about the chilling effect. But I'm a little worried about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the call, Eric.
Thank you for taking.
We want to go to Norfolk, Virginia now and hear from Sarah, who's on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I have a bit of a concern as a mother. I had my baby 6 months ago tomorrow. And at the time I had him, I was told that I could store the cord. And if there was ever a congenital problem or, God forbid, a spinal column, then the stem cells from that cord could help my baby or could help really anyone in our family. At the time, I'm a student. I couldn't afford to store the cord. But in the back of my mind, I was so concerned because as a student, I also realized that our research seems to be stunted in that area. And I was just wondering, we're talking about lives that have not even been, but what about all of the lives that could be helped by the stem cell research that we could do if the administration allowed it? Could you address that?
Dan Greenberg, should I ask you to take that one on?
Well, I think that is the concern about stem cell research and the restrictions the administration has established. Nobody knows for sure at this point where stem cell research will lead. The indications are extremely promising, but that chilling effect is there. Scientists don't have all that much time to make their mark in their profession. And I think quite shrewdly and quite appropriately, if they see there's an area that the federal government is frowning upon, even if to some extent it's permissible to engage in that research, they will look elsewhere. It makes perfect sense for them. Why spend 2, 3, 5 years starting up a line of research and then suddenly there's a political turn and there's no longer funding available for the research? So the president's decision on stem cell research has had that terrible chilling effect on this very promising activity.
I'd like to add a political suggestion for Sarah. This that may sound a little inappropriate in view of the context of this argument, but you know, disease groups or concerned parents of children with diseases have provided enormous political support in this society for important research. They're valuable advocates for things that we need to do. I thought about Sarah's situation, her disappointment at the fact that the cord storage wouldn't be possible in her case. I think there's a real opportunity for people who are worried about what might happen to their own children in the future to become organized and communicate with their government their views about the importance of that kind of future prospect for medical intervention.
What about that, Sarah? Is that something that you feel strongly enough about you'd make a lot of noise about it?
That's actually why I, as an American, go to the voting polls, and I listen to NPR and read all of the newspapers I can so that I can make an informed decision about the candidates that I elect.
All right.
Good for you.
Do I have the time right now? I would love to do something more than vote. I honestly would. As a full-time mother and a full-time nursing student at Old Dominion University, I would love to be able to get onto a platform. But my platform is at home right now. So hopefully my vote alone and the vote of every American that listens and reads and stays informed can make the ultimate decision.
Sounds like you have your hands full, Sarah. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Can't the argument be made, both Dan and Don, that getting to make the rules is just one of the fruits of victory? I mean, why should science be exempt from that?
I don't think anybody would argue with the right of a new president to say, I want to appoint senior officials, including senior officials in some of the science agencies, who agree with the political strategies that brought me to office. I think the president has that right with respect, for example, to the commissioner of the FDA, a job I once had, or the head of the National Institutes of Health, or the president's science advisor. The question is, how deep in the scientific advisory structure is it okay to go for that kind of reason? And I guess my answer is fairly far, but certainly not all the way to the composition of scientific advisory committees or panels that are judging the quality of research on its merits for making funding decisions. Dan, you may or may not agree with that.
Well, I agree. I agree completely, Don. It is often said, and it's been said in this broadcast too, that all presidents do this. That's not completely true. All presidents do some of it, particularly to the upper levels of the scientific bureaucracy. This president has intruded into territory that previously was left sovereign to the professional decisions and wisdom and skills and maybe even the errors of the scientific community. The housekeeping affairs of science, that is, the people who would be appointed to the advisory committees that make the highly technical and scientific decisions, have previously, even in Nixon's time, been left to the scientific community, to the peer review system, which is not infallible, but on the other hand, it works pretty well, and no superior alternative has ever been proposed. This administration is intruding into this territory that previously was considered sacrosanct. That's the big difference.
We want to go back to our phone lines now to Lowell, Massachusetts, and hear from James. Hi, James.
Hello. Given the, I'd like you to comment on the following propositions, if possible. Given that if we could cure 10% of the heart disease that kills about 500,000 of our citizens a year, or if we could extend the average working lifespan of a typical individual 5 years, we could probably solve the entire Social Security deficit problem that we're talking about now, and that we could probably do this for a fraction of the money we're going to spend on going to Mars, which won't extend anyone's lifespan an inch or a day. I would like people to comment on establishing this type of a national goal. Why do we never establish national health goals as, quote, visions, unquote? Bush certainly isn't going to do it. He's captivated by the religious right, of course. But I don't see any of the Democratic candidates doing it either. They issue bland statements like, let's get the country moving again, which is an utterly meaningless remark, but don't set in any of their so-called visions any concrete goal for advancing national health policy by dealing with the day-to-day sicknesses of every person, every citizen. Save 50,000 lives a year from heart disease. We've saved a 9/11 every single month.
All right, James, appreciate the point, and it's a very good question, and certainly one that was heard during the 60s as well, Dan, when we were spending a lot of money to put man on the moon.
Well, James raises a very, very interesting point. And just this past week, the Institute of Medicine, that's part of the National Academy of Sciences, said that within 10 years, we should have a universal health insurance system in this country. Nobody would disagree with that. And they just put out this recommendation, which I think has come out many, many times before, without saying how we should get there, what the politics of it, what the financing of it would be. They simply said, let's have universal health insurance. We don't rally the country politically for health care issues in the same way that, the space establishment with its very skilled public relations apparatus goes after putting people on Mars. When the Clintons came in and they went for national health insurance, I don't think there was very, very much, public support behind them. So this is a very interesting question in American politics. Why perhaps the most crucial issue in domestic policy is our rather ragged health care system, which is good for those who are covered by insurance and dreadful for those who aren't. And why don't we do something about it? Well, we've been talking about this since Harry Truman proposed national health insurance back in the
1948.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, and, Don, is there a better way to make that argument?
Gail, there's another aspect of James's question that I think is very interesting. I mean, he contrasts a kind of knowledge adventure, which the moon colony and Mars trip represent against a kind of research that's very much designed to serve a desperately important human need. Do we have to choose? I think that we're always going to have some of the one kind of work because it yields often very unexpected and wonderful insights that can in turn have applications in human service, versus the other, which we badly need as well. And it seems to me that the fundamental choice here is what are our societal values and how can we arrange economically not to have to make the choice any harder than it needs to be. Remember that we're conducting this kind of choice discourse in a situation in which a second tax cut is being proposed. That, in a way, forecloses the ability to make that choice intelligently.
And Dan, what should be the forum to assess the value of those two fields when you're weighing, you know, space and biomedicine, for example, in terms of which holds more benefit for mankind? Is that something that has to be done at the congressional level? I mean, how do we make those choices as a society?
Well, I think, Gail, it has to be done at various sectors throughout American society. But what I would like to bring up is another dimension that applies to this question quite directly. And that is the general passivity of the scientific community in weighing in on many of these issues. Now, there are some honorable exceptions. I think Don Kennedy has written many powerful editorials in Science, but Science magazine, but that doesn't circulate to the general public. But on many of the issues, such as stem cell research, the folly of going to Mars, the prospect of much greater scientific returns from unmanned missions to space, the true costs of having a large part of the population, 43 million people at the present time, uninsured for health care. The scientific community could have a lot to say on this. It could weigh in politically, and that is it could line up behind candidates who favor many of the goals of the scientific community. But it doesn't do that. In the last election, for example, last presidential election, I mean, there was no doubt that most of the scientists or the scientific leadership favored Al Gore, but you didn't hear a word from them as scientists, and there was scarcely any organized effort in his behalf by scientists.
Dan, we have to take a break, and we'll be continuing our conversation in just a moment. We'd like to hear from you, Connection listeners. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR. My guests this hour are Don Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science magazine, and Daniel Greenberg, author of The Politics of Pure Science. We're investigating the state of science under the Bush administration, and as always, we'd like to hear from you. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we want to begin with Mark, who's on the line from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Hi. I guess I have a problem with scientists expressing political viewpoints because there's a conflict of interest there in that they're receiving grant money. And for instance, someone like me who's in science and has conservative viewpoints, it's difficult for me to express them because, I mean, imagine going to your professor or something and saying, I have an ethical disagreement with taking grant money for this proposal.
Have you had that situation occur?
No, I wouldn't even attempt it. I mean, I can't imagine that it would be good for internal politics or even within the department or anything. So I'm just saying that, you know, they can say they're speaking for scientists, but really the whole system is very skewed to supporting liberal viewpoints because grant money subsidizes them. And until they look for external sources of funding, you know.
Thanks, Mark. And that sounds like a question for Don Kennedy.
Yeah, I think, first of all, I can reassure him that I don't get any grant money anymore. And I bet Dan doesn't either. But still, it's a legitimate complaint that in many academic institutions, a majority of faculty who are in the sciences and who are doing scientific research have liberal political views. Some would prefer to say progressive political views. Some would prefer to say middle-of-the-road political views. I've been a department chairman and had other posts in universities, and I must say, in almost every situation I've been in, there have been graduate students and postdocs with political views that differed quite considerably from those of their faculty mentors. I haven't seen any penalties exacted for that. There may be a kind of conversational bias toward liberal views in those places, but I don't think it hurts people, and I'm disappointed that he's experienced a kind of chilling effect on his own expression. It's too bad.
So, Mark, are you one of the people who were squirming a little bit during the Clinton years, and now you agree with the
position of the Bush
administration?
I'm a libertarian, so I'm all for removing all these bans on stem cell things. It's just, I think it is absurd to research various things about behavior that, unless there's some sort of compelling interest in terms of immediate health interests or security interests, I have a hard time with it.
Mm. All right, Mark, appreciate the phone call.
All right.
Dan and Don, I want to ask you about the conflict of interest issue that is arising here, because there's one committee, for example, on the effects of environmental chemicals on human health, which is replacing nearly all of its members. And one of the new committee members is a California scientist who helped defend Pacific Gas and Electric Company against the real-life Aaron Brockovich, which this may be the most objective scientist on the face of the earth, but it certainly does raise an eyebrow. You know, how important is it to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest?
Well, I think with the conflict of interest issue, it's getting more and more difficult. But there are many antidotes to the difficulties that arise from conflict of interest. One, of course, is disclosure. If a scientist appointed to a committee has a previous history of being associated with one particular side of a controversy, I don't think that necessarily is disabling if it's out in the open and if that scientist has the necessary scientific or technical qualifications. If this is done in a subterfuge, as a subterfuge, and there isn't disclosure, I think then the possibilities for mischief are, quite apparent. Many scientific journals now require authors of papers to certify a number of things. One is that there was no interference with their judgments about what should be published. Another is to disclose any sort of financial connections they have that might in any way have influenced their decisions in writing the paper. So I think we can deal with conflict of interest. I think most of the problems arise when we don't deal with them, turn our backs on them and say, well, it'll be okay. And that's when the difficulties arise.
Don, how do you deal with that at Science Magazine?
Yeah, we ask authors to go through a now fairly elaborate checklist to be sure that they have both recognized and then declared any possible financial connections to the work that they're doing. So I think I agree with Dan that disclosure is a very important antidote. Once disclosure has taken place, however, there's then the question, if you have an advisory committee, how do you make sure that other views are also present? The National Academy of Sciences, when it does studies, makes a very strong effort to balance views on committees that it selects. I think it would be very advisable if administrations did the same thing and if Congress took a look at it to make sure that the balance was there.
Let's hear from Mark now, who's on the line from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark.
Hello. First of all, I'd like to ask your panel what they think of President Bush's pledge of $15 billion for AIDS in Africa. And secondly, I'd just like to say that this has just been an unbelievably one-sided conversation. The panel is one-sided, and sounds more like Bush in 30 seconds than a balanced conversation.
Well, here's your chance to get your word in.
Well, I cheered the announcement of the $15 billion, and we followed the plans for how that was to be allocated carefully. There are still some questions about how that's to be allocated, but I think it was a terrific announcement, and Science Magazine applauded it.
And Mark, let me put the question directly to you. What should we be saying that you haven't heard so far this hour?
Well, I think that the problem with a highly specialized conversation like this is that most people, like myself, cannot argue intelligently about the inner workings of the scientific community. And that's exactly why there should be some sort of a balance on the panel, people that can argue the other side.
Well, what issues are being dealt with that you approve of, that you applaud? I mean, you've heard some of the specific examples in the last hour. Are you saying that you absolutely agree with the way the Bush administration is dealing with scientific issues?
No, absolutely not. But I think that I would probably tend to agree with your panelists, but I don't feel like I can walk away from this hour feeling like I've been exposed to both sides. There are two sides to everything, and we haven't heard the other side.
Okay, appreciate the phone call, Mark. And Dan, it is an interesting issue because I think science is one of those words that if you are not a scientist, you tend to back away from and think, well, this is too complicated, I can't really understand it. How can we get more public engagement with these issues so that they don't feel quite so intimidating?
Well, I think there are many opportunities for the public if it wants to tune in to some of these issues that are internal to the scientific community and the workings of science. I think the public, the general public, is busy with, you know, running, leading their lives and earning a living, taking care of their families and things of that sort. But anybody who wants to follow what's going on, the first place to stop would be at Science Magazine, weekly magazine with a terrific news section. I worked for it ages ago. That tells you more than you perhaps would want to know if you're not professionally involved about the internal workings of the scientific community. The information is there. It's excellently written, well prepared, and thoroughly researched. I think many daily newspapers, you know, particularly the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, give us great windows on what's going on inside the scientific community. So it's no mystery. There's no secrecy about it, or relatively little secrecy. It's there if you want to go hunting for it.
Well, but should you have to go hunting for it? I mean, do you think science is one of the topics that the media covers well?
Let me stick in a note on that, Dan, if I may. I've been a little disappointed. You know, during the late 90s, there was a significant drop in the number of metropolitan dailies in the United States that had special science sections. The number of science journalists, there are some very, very capable people in that field, but I think the number is less than it used to be. And very few of the major television or radio media outlets do serious coverage of science, at least not anything like what National Public Radio does.
We want to go actually, Dan, we're sort of getting tight on time here, so I want to go to High Point, North Carolina, and hear from Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for allowing me to voice my opinion. And I would just like to say that I have a son who, through no fault of his own, 6.5 years ago became a quadriplegic in a car wreck, and I have firsthand experience of what it is like to become paralyzed and be extremely hopeful that stem cell research one day will allow him and others like him to walk again. And what I would like to say is that many people who are very opposed to stem cell research are people who do not have children who are quadriplegics or relatives who are paralyzed or who have not had any firsthand experience with the health issues that afflict these people.
Well, Laura, we appreciate the phone call and the real-life experience that you're bringing to us. Dan and Don, what do you think?
Well, one can only sympathize with Laura. I mean, the purpose of stem cell research isn't purely for scientific entertainment. It's to help people who desperately need help. I think it's rather interesting that Nancy Reagan is for stem cell research because of the medical condition of her husband.
Because of Alzheimer's, exactly.
Yes.
So is there a value-neutral way of arriving at these kinds of decisions? Is there a better way of making these choices about who serves, whose voices get heard, what issues get our attention? Dan?
Well, it's very interesting to me that in the case of stem cell research, there's kind of a bipartisan coalition developing in the Congress. I think that there would be enormous emotional and effective political support for that. Were it possible that people like Laura and Sarah, from whom we heard earlier, would become active public advocates for that kind of work?
Laura, is this something that you've been able to take? I'm sure you must be very occupied with taking care of your son, but have you been able to weigh in politically on these issues as well?
Well, I would certainly like to, and we are very much a supporter of Christopher Reeve's foundation financially, and I just need to know the avenues by which I can become active politically in support of stem cell research. And if I can go online and find out, I would very much appreciate having that information.
Don, what would be your advice for Laura?
I think it would be terrific for her to get in touch with her congressman, make her views known to that person. The member of Congress who's been most active in the kind of promotion of stem cell research that we've been talking about here is Henry Waxman, and he has a site that one can visit.
And just to go ahead.
I would like to add something there. There's no question that the patient advocacy groups, as they're known, have been very, very important for developing financial support for the sciences and political support. But I think the scientific community itself has been largely AWOL for many of these issues. Scientists have great prestige. They are quite wily and well-informed about means of communicating with the public. They can call a press conference and the press shows up. I have not seen scientists beating the drums about the stem cell issue to the extent that they possibly could. Sometimes there's a congressional hearing. Scientists will show up and say, yeah, it's terrible. We wish the president hadn't put these restrictions on stem cell research. But on their own initiative, taking the initiative and bringing this to the attention of the public, I think the scientific community really has been derelict and has something to answer for. They can only rely upon the patient advocacy groups.
Well, we thank both of you so much for being with us. Dan Greenberg, thanks.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dan Greenberg is author of Science, Money, and Politics. And Don Kennedy, thanks so much to you.
Thank you.
Don is editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, a journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. You can continue the conversation at our website, www.theconnection.org. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.